With the weapon of his new army in his hand, Philip first turned his attention to the north of Macedonia. He carried expeditions into Illyria and as far as the Danube. He also spread his power along the coast as far as the Hellespont. He secured possession of a port, Amphipolis, and certain gold mines adjacent. After several Thracian expeditions, he turned southward in good earnest. He took up the cause of the Delphic Amphictyony against those sacrilegious Phocians, and so appeared as the champion of Hellenic religion. There was a strong party of Greeks, it must be understood, a pan-Hellenic party in favour of the Greek headship of Philip. The chief writer of this pan-Hellenic movement was Isocrates. Athens, on the other hand, was the head and front of the opposition to Philip, and Athens was in open sympathy with Persia, even sending emissaries to the great king to warn him of the danger to him of a united Greece. The comings and goings of 12 years can't be related here. In 338 BC, the long struggle between division and pan-Hellenism came to a decisive issue, and at the Battle of Chaeronea, Philip inflicted a crushing defeat upon Athens and her allies. He gave Athens peace upon astonishingly generous terms. He displayed himself steadfastly resolved to propitiate and favour that implacable city, and in 338 BC a congress of Greek states recognised him as captain general for the war against Persia. He was now a man of 47. It seemed as though the world lay at his feet. He'd made his little country into the leading state in a great Greco-Macedonian confederacy. That unification was to be the prelude to a still greater one, the unification of the Western world with the Persian Empire into one world state of all known peoples. Who can doubt he had that dream? The writings of Isocrates convince us that he had it. Who can deny that he might have realized it? He had a reasonable hope of living perhaps another quarter century of activity. In 336 BC, his advanced guard crossed into Asia. But he never followed with his main force. He was assassinated. Second, it's necessary now to tell something of the domestic life of King Philip. The lives of both Philip and his son were pervaded by the personality of a restless and evil woman, Olympias, the mother of Alexander. She was the daughter of the king of Epirus, a country to the west of Macedonia, and like Macedonia, a semi-Greek land. She met Philip, or was thrown in his way, at some religious gathering in Samothrace. Plutarch declares the marriage was a love match, but there seems to be at least this much in the charges against Philip, that like many energetic and imaginative men, he was prone to impatient love impulses. He married her when he was already a king, and Alexander was born to him 3 years later. It wasn't long before Olympias and Philip were bitterly estranged. She was jealous of him, and there was another and graver source of trouble in her passion for religious mysteries. We've already noted that beneath the fine and restrained Nordic religion of the Greeks, the land abounded with religious cults of a darker and more ancient kind, aboriginal cults with secret initiations, orgiastic celebrations, and often with cruel and obscene rites. These religions of the shadows, these practices of the women and peasants and slaves, gave Greece her Orphic, Dionysic, and Demeter cults. They've lurked in the tradition of Europe down almost to our own times. The witchcraft of the Middle Ages, with its resort to the blood of babes, scraps of executed criminals, incantations, and magic circles, seems to have been little else than the lingering vestiges of these solemnities of the dark whites. In these matters, Olympias was an expert and an enthusiast, and Plutarch mentions that she achieved considerable celebrity by use of tame serpents in these pious exercises. The snakes invaded her domestic apartments, and history isn't clear whether Philip found in them matter for exasperation or religious awe. These occupations of his wife must have been a serious inconvenience to Philip, for the Macedonian people were still in that sturdy stage of social development in which neither enthusiastic religiosity nor uncontrollable wives are admired. The evidence of a bitter hostility between mother and father peeps out in many little things in the histories. She was evidently jealous of Philip's conquests. She hated his fame. There are many signs that Olympias did her best to set her son against his father and attach him wholly to herself. A story survives in Plutarch's life that whenever news was brought of Philip's victories, the capture of a city, or the winning of some great battle, he never seemed greatly rejoiced to hear it. On the contrary, he used to say to his playfellows, "Father will get everything in advance, boys. He won't leave any great task for me to share with you." It's not a natural thing for a boy to envy his father in this fashion without some inspiration. That sentence sounds like an echo. We've already pointed out how manifest it is that Philip planned the succession of Alexander and how eager he was to thrust fame and power into the boy's hands. He was thinking of the political structure he was building, but the mother was thinking of the glory and pride of that wonderful lady Olympias. She masked her hatred of her husband under the cloak of a mother's solicitude for her son's future. When, in 337 BC, Philip, after the fashion of kings in those days, married a second wife, who was a native Macedonian, Cleopatra, of whom he was passionately enamoured, Olympias made much trouble. Plutarch tells of a pitiful scene that occurred at Philip's marriage to Cleopatra. There was much drinking of wine at the banquet, and Attalus, the father of the bride, being intoxicated with liquor, betrayed the general hostility to Olympias and Epirus by saying he hoped there would be a child by the marriage to give them a truly Macedonian heir. Whereupon Alexander, taught for such an insult, cried out, "What then am I?" and hurled his cup at Attalus. Philip, enraged, stood up and, says Plutarch, drew his sword, only to stumble and fall. Alexander, blind with rage and jealousy, taunted and insulted his father. "Macedonians," he said, "see there the general who would go from Europe to Asia. Why, he can't get from one table to another." How that scene lives still, the sprawl, the flushed faces, the angry voice of the boy. Next day, Alexander departed with his mother, and Philip did nothing to restrain them. Olympias went home to Epirus, Alexander departed to Illyria. Thence Philip persuaded him to return. Fresh trouble arose. Alexander had a brother of weak intellect, Adidaeus, whom the Persian governor of Caria sought as a son-in-law. Alexander's friends and his mother now infused notions into him again, though perfectly groundless, that by so noble a match, and the support consequent upon it, Philip designed the crown for Aridaeus. Alexander, in the uneasiness these suspicions gave him, sent one Thessalus, a player, into Caria, to desire the grandee to pass by Aridaeus, who was of spurious birth and deficient in point of understanding, and to take the lawful heir to the crown into his alliance. Pixodarus was infinitely more pleased with this proposal, but Philip no sooner had intelligence of it than he went to Alexander's apartment, taking along with him Philotas, the son of Parmenio, one of his most intimate friends and companions, and in his presence reproached him with his degeneracy and meanness of spirit in thinking of being son-in-law to a man of Caria, one of the slaves of a barbarian king. At the same time he wrote to the Corinthians, insisting that they should send Thessalus to him in chains. Harpalus and Nearchus, Phrygius and Ptolemy, some of the other companions of the prince, he banished. But Alexander afterwards recalled them and treated them with great distinction. There's something very touching in this story of the father pleading with the son he manifestly loved, and baffled by the web of mean suggestion which had been spun about the boy's imagination. It was at the marriage of his daughter to her uncle, the king of Epirus, and the brother of Olympias, that Philip was stabbed. He was walking in a procession into the theatre, unarmed, in a white robe, and he was cut down by one of his bodyguard. The murderer had a horse waiting, and would have got away, but the foot of his horse caught in a wild vine, and he was thrown from the saddle by the stumble and slain by his pursuers. So, at the age of 20, Alexander was at the end of his anxiety about the succession and established king in Macedonia. Olympias then reappeared in Macedonia, a woman proudly vindicated. It said that she insisted on paying the same funeral honours to the memory of the murderer as to Philip. In Greece there were great rejoicings over this auspicious event, and Demosthenes, when he had the news, although it was but 7 days after the death of his own daughter, went into the public assembly at Athens in gay attire, wearing a chaplet. Whatever Olympias may have done about her husband's assassin, history doesn't doubt about her treatment of her supplanter, Cleopatra. As soon as Alexander was out of the way, and a revolt of the hillmen in the north called at once for his attention,